Well, welcome everybody. Thank you for joining us this evening. And we'll conduct a formal interview for the first maybe 45 or 50 minutes. There seem to be quite a number of people on the call this evening. So I'll leave 10 or 15 minutes at the end of the call for people to ask David Kramer questions directly. David, first of all, thank you for joining us. I know you've got a pretty busy schedule, and we always welcome having you on to share your insights, knowledge, and wisdom about homeopathy.
Kim, it's delightful to be on again, and I can't thank you enough for allowing me this three-part series. I'm just delighted, and I want to thank you and Whole Health Now. You're always on the cutting edge of new material, and I hope everyone's
got it. Thank you. Thanks, David. I appreciate that. For those of you who are not familiar with David, David, first of all, is one of my closest friends in the homeopathic community and a colleague, somebody who I respect tremendously, both for his integrity as a practitioner, his skills as a practitioner. He's one of the best homeopaths that I know of in the entire world, and an excellent homeopathic educator. He has an incredible ability to communicate clearly really complex principles and ideas in homeopathy. And his school up in upstate New York, the Hudson School, is really one of the finest places to get a real excellent clinical training in homeopathy. So, David, thanks for everything you do. And, again, thank you for taking the time to join us this evening.
My pleasure.
So, David, you know, from our conversations, it's been kind of my understanding that you have the contention that an in-depth conceptualization of Kent's introduction of simple substance plays a very important role in our understanding of really the entirety of homeopathy and even the role of the practitioner as a healer. So could you kind of give us an overview of this? I mean, it's kind of a complex idea, maybe there are some people who are not even perhaps familiar with the whole concept of simple substance, but I know that you've really thought a lot about this. Can you say a little bit more about the nature of simple substance and why it's so important for a homeopathic practitioner and student?
Well, I'll certainly give it my best shot. I'm astonished that that was your understanding from our conversations.
Okay.
Yes. Well, this is an exploration, and this first of the series is really to introduce the idea of simple substance as an introduction. It's a very large exploration, and it's one of the most essential and important components of theory and philosophy for both Kent and Hahnemann. So then to sort of address the question, Kent wrote some amazing material, and in Chapter 8, in Lectures on Homeopathic Philosophy, he presents his entire cosmology of the universe, which no one asked him to do, except he utilizes the opportunity of elucidating Hahnemann's aphorism number 9 as a springboard to do this. And in paragraph 9, Hahnemann gives us the working definition of what health is. And I'd like to recite it at this time in order to refresh the memories of those listeners who may either be unfamiliar with the aphorism or who may not have committed it to memory. And I wonder if it's okay, Kim, if during the reading, if people have questions, should they ask the questions at the end of a passage or wait till the...
You know, David, you could read the passage and then I could open it up if you'd like and people could ask questions.
Okay.
It might be nice.
So just as a historical note, just bear in mind that Kent published these lectures in July of 1900. And at that time, he only had the fifth edition of the Organon to work from, since the sixth edition wasn't discovered until almost 20 years later by Boerke. So this quote that Kent uses from Hahnemann's Aphorism 9 was an 1849 translation from Dugin and reads as follows, and this is the quote. In the healthy condition of man, the spiritual vital force, the dynamis that animates the material body, rules with unbounded sway, and retains all parts of the organism in admirable, harmonious, vital operation as regards both sensations and functions, so that our indwelling, reason-gifted mind can freely employ this living, healthy instrument for the higher purposes of our existence. And by the way, Kim, it should be noted by the listeners that it's critical to remember that Hahnemann uses the phrase sensations and functions in this aphorism, and that the placement of sensation predominates functions. And this is really quite significant, and we'll become aware of the importance of this shortly.
Okay, good. Did you want me to go ahead and see if anybody has any questions, David?
Yes, if you feel that...
It's really up to you. Whatever format you think would work best.
Well, I think this paragraph is pretty clear.
Okay.
And for me, Kim, this paragraph really represents the very essence of healing in a prosaic form.
Mm.
And Kent starts off this lecture by writing before he gets into his cosmology, and he writes, "It would hardly seem possible that Hahnemann, in the time he lived, could say so much in a few lines." And I would actually say the same is true for Kent, who presents this entire lecture on a universal cosmology in only 10 pages. So then anyway, he immediately launches into an explanation of the meaning of Hahnemann's spiritual vital force. And he uses this opportunity of Hahnemann opening up the door to say, in effect, "If we wish to explore the notion of spiritual vital force, then firstly, it must be seen that it doesn't exist in a vacuum. And so it's necessary to view it from its source or its fundamental origins. Because after all, it is this entity, the vital force, that we have identified, that is the absolute thing, as it were, by which we as healers are charged with repairing to its highest sensorial and functional level." And for me, a fundamental question arises here, and that would be, how could we ever hope to repair a mechanism as complex as the human organism if we're not fully aware of exactly how it works on all levels, that is, the physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual levels? So in this way, Kent is, in a way, compelled to reveal and present the larger cosmology behind the origins of the vital force. And he brilliantly uses this aphorism as a bridge to introduce the distinguishing notion of the concepts of force and energy and substance, and in all their possible manifestations. And first he postulates that there exists only two types of substances. And he goes on to say the first substance is what we know as the material or concrete substance, and that's what we've come to know as the existence of all things and forms and everything that exists in the natural world or is derived from nature. So this is just what we know in ordinary life. But the second substance is what he refers to as immaterial or simple substance. And here he wants to say that it's a substance of a different quality than what we've come to know and what exists as what we know in the material world. And he writes a very simple sentence. He says, "Substance in simple form is just as positively substance as matter in concrete form." So he begins his exposition in this matter in order to demonstrate the originating parameters and actual mechanism of the vital force, which is an astonishing undertaking. And that as a force or an energy, he postulates that there is a certain something that precedes its energetic manifestations. And in a way, he'd like to make this concept very, very clear. So, for example, before one can obtain the energy of a fire, for example, there first needs to exist some combustible material that allows the fire to exist. Before there's electric for our household, as it were, there needs to be a nuclear or hydropower plant that must exist prior to the production of the electricity, and so on. He really wants to be very, very clear that one genuinely comprehends that something precedes energy, and that our spiritual vital force is preceded by another type of form. And thereby, by extrapolation, one can only ultimately deduce that there must be the existence of an ultimate form. And this he gives the name of a supreme deity or god, if you will, or whatever else you wish to refer to the cause of all things. That is, the thing that existed just prior to the beginning of the Big Bang, but also eventually leads us, as we shall see later on, to the formation of intelligent laws and principles that are uniform in their governance throughout the entire universe. Kant has an amazing reasoning behind this, I believe. It's to present the unfolding of a flawless cosmology which accounts for the existence of all things. And this then is predicated upon the foundation of the existence of a supreme entity. And so he approaches this phenomenology in this way, so there'll be no confusion as to which came first, the chicken or the egg kind of syndrome. That is, he's saying categorically, form precedes energy. And this is so much more true today than in Kant's time, that is, this confusion with our contemporary views and even sometimes fantastic notions of the kind of energies that exist for this thing or that thing. He wants to be very clear that something precedes energy. And then Kant writes, if a man can think of energy as something substantial, he can better think of something substantial as having energy. And when he thinks of something that has essence, has actual being, he must think of that S, or essence, as something existing and having something which has ultimates. So Kim, just to clarify here for a moment, Kant speaks of ultimates here as the very finest particles that a thing can disintegrate to, because there's beginnings, intermediates, and ultimates, the ends. So as people, we've come to know it in our culture and in our lives as a reference to the physical body, where we move from birth to midlife and into death, and the ultimate would be the ashes to ashes and dust to dust idea that we've come to know.
Right.
So to continue with this paragraph, Ken continues, he says, he must think in a series whereby cause enters into effect, and furthermore, into a series of effects. If he does not do this, he destroys the very nature and idea of influx and continuance. If man does not know what is continuous, if he does not know that there are beginnings, intermediates, and ends, he cannot think, for the very foundation of thought is destroyed. It's a very powerful argument. And this is very intense philosophical material, but it's essential, I feel, in comprehending the very foundational underpinnings of our human experience, and that is the purpose of life itself and the true nature of the vital force, which are the age-old questions, you know, why am I here, who am I, etc.
Sure, sure. I mean, certainly that's a huge discussion. I'm curious, can you say more just about the nature of simple substance, and especially, can you explain the importance of influx and continuance? What roles do those play specifically in simple substance?
I'll address those in just 1 minute, and I just wanted to make another point here.
Sure.
About the purpose of life, since this is the answer to all things. This is the teleconference. This is the one that we're going to put over Oprah.
Okay, sounds good.
So to fail to understand the essence and meaning of the spiritual vital force is to be only partially informed regarding the true nature of this entity, which in fact is the sole and actual governing mechanism of the healing process. So this is one essential aspect of the healing arts, which I believe that we really need to know as healers. So in essence, that's why Kant's material on simple substance plays such a critical role in comprehending the vital force. And remember, Kant says in his later writings that the whole aim of being a homeopath is to bring someone into a state of freedom. Kant was very keen on the notion of freedom.
Mm.
And so if we don't know all the parameters to this absolute freedom, we can only partially fulfill our mandate, which Hahnemann states very clearly in paragraph 1, which I'm sure everyone knows, And he says, the physician's highest and only mission is to restore the sick to health, to cure as it is termed. And Kent clarifies that. And what we principally need to be cognizant of in this phrase is to cure as it is termed, but it's not to be termed by man, but by great nature, which exists itself and operates under those very same laws of the vital force. So basically, this material represents the all and everything existing in the universe, of which humanity is only one small component. But nonetheless, we share the same lawfulness as any other entity in the universe, but only according to our human form and our human nature. But at the same time, with all the characteristics and attributes that are identified as a human being. So essentially, you might say then that simple substance is the whole enchilada.
Hmm.
And getting back to your question about influx and continuance, which is really critical to understanding this, the fundamental essence of all things that exist is that they adhere to the laws of influx and continuance, and they're contained within simple substance, Kent says. So then for our purposes, we can define influx as the point at which one thing flows into another. That is, it's the starting point or a beginning. And this beginning is always in relationship to a something else. So very simply, it can be viewed as analogous to the proverbial pebble that's tossed into the pool of water. And that initial force of the pebble might be viewed as the initial starting point or influx. But from that initial ripple effect, there's a corresponding action on all other water molecules as the ripple proceeds, with the same information starting from the first, and we might refer this continuance or this phenomena as the continuance. So really, influx and continuance then is all about initiation and perpetuation. And Kent again wishes painstakingly to make it very, very clear that everything without exception existing in the universe began and continues to this present day according to the laws of influx and continuance. And they're both contained as an integral aspect of simple substance, the stuff we can't see. And whether one views it as God creating the universe or the Big Bang Theory, the resulting consequences still remain the same. I mean, so in this regard, then, whether from the religious or the atheistic point of view, this is really one area where everyone shares a common ground. That is, there was, in fact, a beginning at one point, and that beginning started and continues up to the present moment. And just parenthetically, and interestingly enough, it will ultimately end in about 4.5 billion years from now, give or take, when it's predicted by scientists to either explode or implode upon itself. And for anyone out there who feels anxiety, if they have fear of impending danger, if they have anxiety about the future, delusions, the world will end, lose any sleep over it, I suggest, and I think it might be prudent to seek out treatment from your homeopath as soon as possible. But anyway, in regard to influx and continuance, Kent uses the metaphor of a great chain where one link of the chain is connected to the next and so on. And he states the obvious. Where there's a break or separation in the chain, influx and continuance cease, and there is no longer influx from one link to the other. So, Kim, that's essentially the basic idea of influx and continuance as it pertains to simple substance.
So, David, I mean, I can see how that might be of interest to, like, if you were a theologian or an astrophysicist, but in terms of just how does that apply to a human being? What impact does it have on our existence specifically?
Ah, Kim, you're always the pragmatist. All right, then. This is where, for me, this is where it gets really exciting. So Kent puts forth the idea that the existence of influx and continuance in simple substance can be clearly seen in terms of the human body. That is, as its beginnings, intermediates, and ends, birth, life, and then ultimately death. The physical body is obvious that it's made from material substance, and it belongs to that first substance or concrete substance. But he further contends that we do not see all of the finer purposes of our being. That's the stuff that interests me. That's the stuff that comprises the essence of our being and maintains the purposefulness and meaning of human life and of human existence. And this immaterial substance resides not in the concrete material substance of the physical body alone, but rather in the secondary, finer, immaterial substance or simple substance. And this is precisely why, and this really gets me excited, and this is precisely why Hahnemann places sensations before functions in paragraph 9, because he knows there's a certain sensory apparatus that exists with the spiritual vital force connected to its own existence, its own simple substance, that has the possibility to inform itself or inform the individual when life is not proceeding as it should according to the mandate given to it. Because the vital force, after all, as Hahnemann says, is the vice regent of the soul, and the soul then goes back to the beginnings. And so he'd want to say that its composition is derived of simple immaterial substance rather than a state of energy, as most of us have come to believe. So therefore, if Kent really is accurate in what he's saying, this becomes a radical shift in the way we need to perceive the universe, ourselves, and all other things related to one another. And there's a lot of contemporary scientific evidence to support Kent's assertions, and he was decades ahead of today's unification theories, for example, and Einstein's theory of relativity, because that's really what he's approaching. And even currently, the scientific community is talking about something called dark matter, which is a concept some of the listeners may be familiar with, and which is that theoretical and mechanically or mathematically calculated missing stuff that constitutes more than 90% of the material that should exist in the universe, but that scientists can't account for. They just can't find it. So in fact, today, billions of dollars are being spent on intensive scientific research and the building of enormous cyclotrons, which are intended to identify the very simple substance that Kent spoke about 100 years ago. So as a friend of mine once said, and it may have even been you, Kim, the scientists are very slowly catching up to the yogis.
David, very interesting. You have something else you want to say about that? Good, I'm sorry.
I just have another couple of...
Yeah, please, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interject. Go ahead.
That's okay, I'm having a great time.
Go ahead, David.
So... anyway, back to the simple substance and how it directly relates to the overall human experience. I'm going to quote again from Kent, and he says, "To believe that man exists without a cause, to believe that his life goes on for a while and does not exist from something prior to it, to think that there is not constantly and continuously that influx from cause whereby he continues to live, demonstrates that that man or woman who does so is an irrational being." Pretty strong language, but, you know, he's following in the good steps of Hahnemann.
Right.
He says, "From his senses, man has never been able to prove that anything can exist except it has flowing into it that which holds it in continuance." And essentially he's saying a rock is a rock is a rock. And he continues, "Then why should he, when he goes into the immaterial world, that is, immaterial substance, assume that energy is the first? We shall find by a continued examination of the question of simple substance that we have reason for saying that energy is not energy per se, but that it's a powerful substance and is endowed from intelligence that is itself a powerful substance. And this is very remarkable writing and radical then, even radical now. And he goes on further to add that the true holding together of the material world is performed by simple substance. And shortly later, he extends this notion to the entire universe. But it's the idea that simple substance has an intelligence, that it has its influx from the absolute or the great beginning, depending on your personal orientation, it doesn't matter. But that's what persuades Kent to postulate that while all things are under universal lawfulness of influx and continuance, it is humanity that is endowed with the privilege of being the highest formation. So now, here's the essential principle. Are you ready, Kim?
Yeah, please.
All right. Everything material that exists in the universe is held together and performed by this other non-material substance called simple substance, Kent says. So one of the properties of simple substance is that it has intelligence. And he says that it's ordained to each and everything from that first beginning, and that this intelligence is given to every material form that occupies according to the purpose of its own existence, which has been predetermined by the initiating cause of all causes. Therefore, since humanity exists and continues, and hopefully we do, as a result of simple substance, we occupy a purpose just like every other thing in the universe. And we rank in the possibility of our being of the highest order of things because of one quality that we have that no other thing has that we know of, and that's our unique ability to have reason. And interestingly enough, in the ancient Hebraic texts, it states the difference between man and animal is our ability to reason. And this is where our role as homeopathic healers come into play. So Kent says, hence, man and all forms are subject to the laws of influx. And if man is the highest order and is rational, he wills to keep himself in continuous order, that his thoughts may continue rational. But, and this is the important part, but he is so placed in freedom that he can destroy his rationality. So there's the rub, as Bill Shakespeare once commented. So Kim, free will, as it were, represents either the bane or the movement toward the full potentiality of our existence. Rock has no free will, for example. It can only be a rock. But humanity was ordained with the power of rationality and free will as its mandate, just like a rock was ordained to be a rock.
Sure.
But we have this free will, and this free will is the thing that becomes separated from its simple substance. The influx and the continuance becomes compromised. So our job as healers, then, is principally to restore to the patient a healthy, rational free will, as it was originally intended to be, back to the individual, back to the patient. This then, according to Kent and Hahnemann and myself, restores the healthy influx and continuance of simple substance, and then each individual has the possibility to choose, and maybe this is the only time we have a choice, to marshal whatever strength of character and free will to determine if they wish to fulfill the higher purposes of their existence. And so I tell my students in my advanced classes, the very first symptoms of chronic disease is the loss of reason. So Kim, I know this is...
David, I'm curious, because today at least it seems that we live in a fairly irrational society. I mean, certainly historically there have been periods of time where, you know, cultures and societies have been fairly irrational, and others where they've been less irrational and more reasoned. But at least today, it seems pretty irrational. I'm curious if you have any ideas on why that's the case, and what role homeopathy has to play in addressing that whole situation.
Well, that's a great question, and my sense of it is that there has been a disconnect of the influx and continuance of, if the vital force is the vice regent of the soul, and the soul receives directly all that pure material, and it comes into an organism that is, because of various reasons, including miasmatic predisposition, and this is certainly substantiates everything that Hahnemann has to say. If the organism is fouled up from the beginning through genetic predisposition, through miasmatic predisposition, and then, and especially now, through vaccination, through medications, through inhumane information, through the proliferation of the amount of information we receive on a daily basis, and it goes against or distorts the original intention of the information that was to be received from a pure source, the reason is lost. The highest capacity is reason, and thought is part of that, but when thought becomes distorted, it changes and skews the perception of reality. And so we justify ourselves based on a skewed perception of reality. I mean, it was Dostoevsky, and one of my favorite lines from one of his novels is, I'm amazed how we deceive ourselves by putting reason on our side. And so we receive this information, it comes to us as pure, and then it gets distorted. And, you know, we have very practical experience of this at a very young age when we all play telephone. Remember, you're all in a circle, and
sure.
Someone started a sentence like, Johnny went to the store, and by the time it comes around to the last person, it's like, Johnny's getting an Uzi and shooting up the school.
Man.
And so that kind of distortion is exactly the distortion that occurs in our mental process, in our reasoning, in our thinking, because we have a distorted view of reality, that the original sin may really have been miasmatic layer.
David, you still there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, I thought maybe I lost you. I'm sorry about that.
So does that somewhat address?
Yeah, and what about homeopathy as a way of? How do you use? I'm curious. How do you use? Because this is all very fascinating, very interesting stuff. But how do you use it to help yourself with your patients in terms of homeopathic practice?
That's the most wonderful thing.
Yeah,
people come in for their presenting symptoms. And this is, you know, if it didn't bother them, they wouldn't come in. I never have anyone come in and say, I'm perfectly healthy, physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. I want you to treat me. No one's ever done that in 25 years. I'm still waiting.
Yeah, I hear you.
So people come in for their presenting symptoms, and I have a favorite story about presenting symptoms. It's about a great master who's walking in the woods, and he's enjoying the day, and he's meditating, and he's on a smallish dirt road, and it's a glorious spring day, and he hears some commotion around a bend, and he turns the bend, and he sees a young woman a couple of hundred yards up the road from him, and she's with a donkey, and the donkey is smack dab in the middle of the road. And obviously, from what he can see and what he can hear, the donkey's not going anywhere, and she's yelling at it and pulling on it and calling it all kinds of nasty names and getting a little bit more active than the master feels comfortable with. So he goes up to her and says, young lady, you know, this beast of burden is willing to work with you, and he's willing to do all the labor that you ask, but not if you treat him this way. You have to treat him with love and kindness and dignity and nurture him and really respect him. And the owner gets more and more irritated, and she hands the reins of the donkey to the master with an arrogant gesture and says, well, if you're so smart, let's see what you can do. And she backs off to one side of the road. And the master, knowing a great deal about donkeys and asses in general, drops the reins, knowing he's not going to go anywhere, and he walks up the road another 50 yards or so and comes back with a very large stick about the size of a baseball bat, and very lovingly, very, very lovingly and warmly, looking the donkey square in the eyes, he hauls back and hits the donkey as hard as he can in the head. And she said, "What the heck are you doing? I thought you had to treat him with love and respect and kindness and dignity and nurture him." He says, "Yes, you have to do all those things, but first you have to get his attention." And so that's what the presenting symptoms are.
Right.
That get the person's attention. And that's the thing. The vital force is always going to, as Hahnemann says, the vital force is not designed to cure. The vital force has a lot of things that it is designed and required to do by mandate, but curing is not one of them. And one of the things it's supposed to do, it's supposed to sacrifice the lesser for the greater. And we see this. If we're in a situation, or we see a terrible, or we hear a terrible situation where someone says, "Well, do you want your little finger cut off, or do you want your whole arm cut off?" We're going to opt for the lesser. And that's how it is in all circumstances. So pain is the great attention getter. And once we remove the presenting symptoms, what's behind that pain is a different kind of pain, but it's not going to be on the concrete material substance level. It's going to be on the immaterial substance level. And unless we have the capacity to see that, we won't know how to treat people. So as someone gets healthier and healthier and they start to say things like, "You know, all my presenting symptoms are gone, but I still feel there's something wrong." This is the sensation that Hahnemann's speaking about in paragraph 9, sensation and function. "I just have a feeling something's not right with my life. I don't have anything outwardly to complain about, but there's something really missing about my life." This is the call of spirit, of vital force, saying you're not on the right road to fulfilling the higher purpose of your existence. And unless we understand what that means, we're not going to be able to work with the individual to bring them to that higher level where they can fulfill the purposefulness of their existence. And just today, as a matter of fact, one of my patients who I hadn't seen in the last 6 weeks had gone away on a meditation retreat for 10 days. And I'd been treating her fairly well for a period of time and had quite good results with her physical presenting symptoms and some emotional stuff as well. And she was fairly pleased with the treatment in the time we're working together. And it was my sense that she was really not in touch with something in her authentic self. And I recommended that she go to a certain meditation retreat, and I saw her for the first time today since she's back, and she said it was the most wonderful experience she'd ever had in her life. And any of the symptoms that I'd been treating her for physically, and she was sitting for 10 hours a day in meditation, and she had some pains in the limbs and so on and so forth, all of her symptoms, without exception, were gone during the time that she was meditating. She gave herself the gift. She took away the stress, the tension, the lack of acknowledgement of herself. If we don't see this in an individual as they emerge, like a caterpillar goes into a cocoon, and do you know that what the word... literally, do you know what butterfly literally translated in Greece means?
No, David, can you tell us?
It means soul.
Uh-huh.
And so when the caterpillar goes into this chrysalis, into this darkness that it creates for itself, it doesn't pull out all its fur and chop off a bunch of legs. It melts down into a gelatinous mass and is transformed into this new entity of a higher quality that it emerges, and we call it butterfly. So every cell, every molecule knows what to transform itself into. And this is what we have as a possibility as healers of doing with our patients. But we need to be able to see that as their simple substance in very subtle terms, because the thing that is wrong, the thing that's not quite right, are not so much the overt problems financially, relationships, jobs, and so on and so forth. It's something else, and that something else belongs to the realm of simple substance.
Mm. So, David, I've always appreciated this about yours and Ilona's work, and that you always see homeopathy as more than just simply, of course, you like to remove people's physical suffering, but that homeopathy is more than just removing their physical suffering. It's really, as Hahnemann says in the ninth aphorism of the Organon, the catalyst for allowing them to reach the lofty goal of human existence. I'm just curious, could you tell us what you think that lofty goal of human existence is? And if you don't think that's a fair question, that's fine, but I'm always curious what people, how people read that. It's
not only a fair question,
yeah.
It's the most essential question.
Okay, good.
I'd be disappointed if you didn't ask.
Okay, good.
What we are all endowed with a purposefulness. This is what Kent is saying in essence. We're endowed with our individuality, with our own essence. Whatever that essence was ordained to become, that's the fulfillment of our higher purpose. It's not very complex, but it's difficult to achieve, but it's not a complex. How to be the essence of who I am and live that as my way of life.
Hmm.
So if you're a musician, be a musician. If you're an artist, be an artist. If you're a street cleaner, be a street cleaner. And even if you don't have an occupation that mirrors some sort of creative venture, having a sense of purposefulness is really the most valuable thing. And, you know, it's very interesting. I don't know if you or any of the other listeners have had any experience with the elderly. By the way, they're going to refer to us one day as that, but
sooner than later.
But if you've ever been to a community that's for a retirement community where there are elderly, there's no joy because there's no children. And in all instances, because I've worked in circumstances like that, they want to feel productive. They'll say, I just want to feel useful. And that's their vital force that's healthy enough to say, I want to fulfill even in my infirmed state, even in my disabled state, I want to feel like I'm fulfilling some purposefulness and not sitting in this wheelchair and watching a television.
Mm-hmm.
So even from early on when children are creative and they put rocks together and they draw whatever they draw and so on and so forth, from the earliest ages to the latest parts of life, there's this creative need to be fulfilled. And everyone is asking for it in one way or another. And what we've done through the distortion of reality, and there's, I think, maybe another teleconference will be why in American society or why in Western technology, the vital force has gotten so distorted in its view of reality that it's come to the point where we're almost really exterminating ourselves on our host planet.
Hmm.
But the essence of why we're here is really to come closest to the essence within myself. And how are we going to teach our patients or guide them or facilitate them to have contact with that most essential nature in themselves if we ourselves, as practitioners, have not achieved that? Here's a good example. I've had lots of patients, and their presenting symptoms are gone, and then they say life is, you know, there's something wrong. And I say, well, what's wrong? And they say, well, you know, I'm not happy at my job. I really, the friends that I've been friends with, you know, for 20 years, they don't really seem to offer me anything. My relationship with my partner is sort of stale. I don't know where I'm going in life. So if you repertorize that, you're going to think of, you know, discontented. But what if it's really a call from vital force and simple substance to say, hey, there's a finer substance that wants to be acknowledged, and those coarser realities no longer correspond with this thing that you've just made healthier. And so if you start giving remedies for someone who's discontented, who's critical of others, you'll actually kill their spirit. How are we going to recognize that when we bring someone to the point of getting rid of the coarser symptoms and then revealing the simple substance symptoms? That's what we need to do.
Very interesting. David, you know, I could sit here and ask you questions all evening, but I would like to give other people an opportunity to ask some questions also. Before I do that, let me just mention that if you want more information about David or his school, as I mentioned earlier, he's the founder of the Hudson Valley School of Classical Homeopathy in upstate New York, which he runs with his wife, Ilona Kramer. If you want more information, you can check out their website, which is www.classicalhomeopathy.com. So www.classicalhomeopathy.com, or you can email them at classicalhomeopathy@earthlink.net. And also, I wanted to mention that David is going to be coming out with a book called Fear, Impulse, Desire, The Anatomy of Disease and the Struggle for Self-Perfection. And David, that book is planned to come out by the end of the year, is that correct? Or?
Yes, that's my hope.
Okay. Well, that's great, and we're very much looking forward to reading that, and also for the second two parts of this teleconference series. Let me go ahead and open it up and see if some other people have some other questions as well. Hold on a second. Does anybody have any questions they'd like to ask David?
Yeah, hi, Ken. This is Richard Pitcairn.
Who is this, Richard Pitcairn?
Yeah, hi, Ken.
Hey, Richard, welcome to the call.
Thanks. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, I can hear you just fine. Go ahead, Richard.
Well, I wanted to bring up another angle on this. I have felt like there's sometimes a misunderstanding of what Hahnemann says is possible with homeopathic treatment. Can I address that for a moment?
Sure, Richard, go ahead.
Yeah, I think one of the best examples of what Hahnemann tells us about that is in the Organon, in the part on mental-emotional diseases. And if I could just read one paragraph to you, it's not a real long one. It's in footnote 210. Would that be all right?
Oh, you're good.
He says, this is Hahnemann here in the footnote. He says, one often encounters patients with the most painful, protracted diseases who have a mild, gentle, emotional mind such that the medical art practitioner feels impelled to bestow attention and sympathy upon them. If the physician conquers a disease and restores the patient again, in other words, cures them of the disease, the physician is often astonished and startled at the dreadful alteration of the patient's emotional mind. The physician often meets with ingratitude, hard-heartedness, deliberate malice, and the most degrading, the most revolting tempers of humanity, qualities that were precisely those possessed by the patient in former healthy days. So I think he's making very clear here that homeopathy cannot be expected to improve the personality, but rather what it does is it restores a person to the state they were in before they became ill. And that state may not be a very pleasant one. Does that make any sense to you at all?
Sure. Did you want to comment on that, David?
Well, you know, we have to restore the sick to health, to cure as it is termed, and it's clear that Hahnemann says to their former healthy state. It's my contention that many people have never really experienced a former healthy state. And as a consequence, I don't disagree with the reading. I would want to enlarge upon it and say, here's a good example. You have a young child, and they're very violent, and they have they're a tubercular child. So there's a lot of violence, a lot of discontentment, and so on and so forth. They're born tubercular. They cried early on. They were violent as youngsters. They're discontented in their as they get older. In this regard, what was their former healthy state? Hello?
Yeah, David, hold on. Richard, did you want to? Are you asking that for Richard to answer?
Sure.
Well, I think we have to make a distinction between, I guess we have to say, a normal state and one that's been altered by disease. I think the word healthy is a difficulty here because only, you know, that the word is only a symbol and it represents something to David and probably something else to me and to again to Kim. When we say healthy, then we think in terms of what a person should be like to be optimal and so on. But in this paragraph and in other places, this is one of the best examples, but Kahneman is telling us basically that homeopathy treatment that's successful will return the patient to the state they were in before. And I think that much of contemporary homeopathy has the idea that it actually is going to make people better in a more spiritual sense. And I don't think that's the right understanding of it. I think if we say the person before they were ill was in a certain had a certain type of personality, and that personality may have been unpleasant. We would expect then if they become ill and they're altered and we treat them successfully, they will become unpleasant once again. That's what Hahnemann is telling us, and that's certainly been my experience as well. So, you know, this is where I'm having some disagreement with that interpretation. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Richard, I'm curious. Well, how do you interpret aphorism 9 when Hahnemann talks about the purpose of homeopathy is to allow the patient to reach the lofty goal of human existence?
Yes, I think I understand that. And I think what he's telling us, the way I interpret this, is Hahnemann's telling us that, let me start over. I think one way to look at this is to think in terms of homeopathy as a method as having limits. In other words, we have a sphere of experience that's outside the realm of homeopathy. That is what David was talking about. But we are here, we have a physical form, we have a mind, we have experiences. But these are areas that Hahnemann didn't try to explain or to try to treat. He's saying that the vehicle that we have for our experience in the world can become mistuned by illness, by disease. And homeopathy treatment will restore that instrument back to balance so we can use it for whatever purposes we came here to apply.
Okay.
That doesn't mean homeopathy is telling us how to live our lives. It's just telling us it can correct the instrument.
Right.
Okay, so Richard,
can I make a
very interesting conversation, and maybe we could continue on one of the questions. I'd like to give some other people an opportunity to also ask questions.
Yeah.
I do appreciate it very much, Richard. It's very interesting. Anybody else has any questions they would like to ask David?
Kim, David, I have a comment. This is Mary from Boston.
Hi, Mary.
Yeah, hi. And I think what you're referring to, David, in Aphorism 9, when you speak of someone whose symptoms and everything, they're in perfect balance, and yet they still say to you, I'm discontented. And I think there's a Sanskrit word for that known as vipralamba, which means the agony of separation. And that what they're referring to there is that agony of separation from self, mm-hmm. or from being self-realized, or from realizing that one's true self is that of spirit or God or whatever you want to call it. And until you make that connection as to the true self, which all humanity is, this true self, and if you stay stuck in just thinking you're a personality, you will always run into discontentment because you're more than just that. You are that, in other words. And so, you know, it's sort of Eastern philosophy. They would say that the most supreme reason for being is to realize you are that, or self-realization. And I think that's the simple substance of the soul, which is that. least that's been my experience, my personal.
Who's speaking now? Just your name?
This is Mary Terhune
Mary.
From Boston.
Mary, I just want to clarify, your position is that not only that is the purpose of a human existence, but that homeopathy can act directly to allow us to achieve that goal. Is that your position?
Homeopathy can bring us to a place of balance where perhaps those portals can open. In other words, the first thing that a person feels when they take the Similimum is this great sense of well-being. And that is what's being touched on, that self, when you have that state of well-being, and that people feel so well they can't quite believe it.
See. Okay, good. Thank you. Do you have a question with that, or just that was just a comment that you wanted to...
I mean, I think that's the thing that David's speaking of. I could be wrong, but...
Okay, all right. David, did you want that, or...
I think that Mary's got it pretty much. Our potentiality is greater than the way we manifest in the world generally, unless we make intentional efforts to do that. And, I agree with her comments and thank her for them.
Okay, great. Good. Let me see if anybody else has any additional questions or comments.
Tim, this is Ron. I have a question for David.
Yeah, Ron, please go ahead.
Is there some connection here between simple substance and reincarnation?
Well, nothing like opening up a proverbial can of worms. There may well be, and I'm going to entice you to listen to next week when we listen to all the qualities of simple substance. But to address the question directly, Kent is opening up a door for an exploration of a many great number of things, and one might be inclined to say, well, you know, if you can't destroy simple substance and something happens to everything that breaks down, if it's ashes to ashes and dust to dust, you can't destroy that other stuff. It doesn't disappear from the universe. What happens to it? And then we get into the notion of when everything breaks down into its ultimates, and it breaks down into simple substance. What are the possibilities of simple substance once it's returned to its ultimates? And that opens up the door for exploring the possibility of reincarnation. Yeah, and he's not saying it in those specific terms. But as I say, this is a very large exploration, and that's certainly one viable way of looking at things.
Okay, good. David, I think we have time for just one more question. And then remember, we will be having two more calls in this series. So if you didn't get your questions answered, please join us for the next two calls. And perhaps also, Richard, you'll be on as well, and we can further the discussion. I think it was a very interesting discussion that you and Dave were having, so perhaps we can continue that on one of the future calls. So I'm going to unmute the lines for just one more question. Anybody have a question they'd like to ask David before we end tonight's session?
Tim, this is Claudia.
Go ahead, please, Claudia.
I want to go back to something, David, that you said about the tuberculum child. You were asking, so what would be the health, the idea of health or the well-being sense for that child? Could I say that maybe that will be the initiation time? Like that influx is like that memory of health that we lose when we have the miasmatic illness or something?
If I understand you correctly, you're asking if, with regard to the tubercular child, what can we expect that would be a consequence from homeopathic treatment?
No, when you were having the discussion with Richard, you were saying, so what will be that idea of health and well-being from a child that has been sick since he was born? Like, he has been with all this violence and everything. So could I assume that maybe we all have this feeling of health and well-being and happiness that comes from the initiation time, from the influx? And that's what homeopathy will restore if it's the right remedy?
That's what it, I believe that it can do. It's basically that the healthy vital force is covered up by things. And the more you remove the clutter, the distortion, I mean, in fact, Hahnemann does use the term reorganization as he applies it to vital force. The more the organization, the more the economy is reorganized, the more efficient it becomes, the smoother an organism it becomes in order to function in the way that it was originally designed to function. Does that address your question?
David, I think we're going to have to continue this discussion because we're 2 minutes after the hour.
Oh.
So I'm going to go ahead and unmute the lines. And everybody, let's give David a big thank you. It was a very interesting discussion and call, and we're all very eager to continue to hear your thoughts on Simple Substance and Kent's philosophy. So I'm going to go ahead and unmute the line.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
Hi, David.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, everybody.
Bye, David. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Kim.
Bye.
Bye-bye.